Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metropolitan area, 91.9 in Hood River and the Gorge. Well, up to the Dalles, I believe.
To the Dalles.
To the Dalles. In the Willamette River Valley, it's 100.7. And in the ether, that being on the internet, it's www.kboo.fm. Good morning, good morning. This is More Talk Radio. I am Celeste Carey. I'm here with my cohort in conversation.
I'm Cecil Prescott.
Yeah, that's you. And we welcome you to More Talk Radio here today. We have a guest to talk about some of the ballot initiatives that are coming out of California and Oregon and how they are being shaped and shaping our consciousness when it comes to living together as a diverse and powerful population. The Western U.S. history has long represented a golden future, even manifest in our political policy of manifest destiny. And no state exemplifies the West more than California as a state of opportunity and progress. However, that does not seem to be the case these days, as an area in which we look to for bright ideals, equal opportunity, has found itself caught not only in some really frightening partisan politics in terms of immigration and equality and equity, but really disturbing and divisive policies that have pit communities against each other and even manifested some really disturbing, I guess we'll call them obstructionist attitudes coming out of the progressive community. We have with us here today Professor Daniel Martinez Hosang, who is the author of Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives and the Making of Postwar California. Good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure is ours, truly, truly. As the Assistant Professor of Ethnic Studies and Political Science at the University of Oregon, you were a 2008 to 2009 resident scholar at the university's Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics, got your PhD in American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, and your dissertation was Racial Propositions, Genteel Apartheid in Postwar California. It was awarded the Best Dissertation Prize from the American Studies Association and others. Just a little bit on what you had experienced to make that an idea that you wanted to capture, crystallize, and put before us in this so-called land of opportunity where we seem to be cutting opportunity off at the knees.
Sure. Well, I'd worked as a community organizer through most of the 1990s in California, primarily in the Bay Area. So a lot of the ballot measures that I write about in the book, the effort to defeat affirmative action, to expand California's really monstrous prison system, to make citizenship a qualification for receiving any public benefits, to eliminate bilingual education, unfolded as I was in the state. And I was always struck by how these measures could pass, even as really a large majority of the population very seriously claimed that they embraced quite liberal values, rights, and opinions. And so I was really interested in that contradiction, how we could have a state that so treasured ideas of progress and human capacity and possibility on the one hand, and continue by really large margins to pass measures that eliminated whole sections of public life to, a not small portion of the population.
Perhaps you can tell us, tell our audience, what were some of the propositions that Californians faced in the 90s and into the new millennium that they passed?
Sure, sure. So in 1994, a measure called Three Strikes and You're Out, similar to Oregon's criminal sentencing measures that launched what one analyst called the largest prison construction project in human history, really, prison expansion project. A measure that year also that made citizenship status determination of access to all public benefits and required even kindergarten teachers to serve as immigration de facto agents. That was Proposition 187. That was also 1994. In 1996, there was Proposition 209. California became the first state to consider the elimination of public affirmative action programs in higher education, but also in contracting. In 1998, a measure to eliminate public bilingual education programs and replace them with a one-size-fits-all so-called immersion strategy for English language learners. That was Prop 207. In 2000, both a measure to ban the recognition of same-sex marriage. It was a predecessor to Prop 8 2 years ago, but also a measure to increase criminal sentencing for juvenile offenders, and that was Prop 21. And these faced an electorate that was actually dominated by Democrats, that had the statewide officials were all Democratic at this time, and each one of these measures passes by a large margin. So I talk both about that, but also about California's long, really 50-year history of passing measures like this in the name of so-called progress.
So let us talk about the consciousness that kind of formed the basis for moving out and helping these measures pass resoundingly. What was the attitude? What was the political attitude, both in terms of progressive politics and as in terms of more conservative and exclusionary politics?
Well, I think a couple of things are important to keep in mind. I think when people talk about progressive commitments, they often talk about how they feel as individuals and whether they consciously or intentionally like or dislike particular groups of people. So you have this contradiction, for example, Prop 187, which, again, would eliminate education, public health, a whole range of services to undocumented immigrants. And force all public officials to be de facto immigration agents. And even the supporters said, you know, this is not an anti-immigrant initiative. They would claim their own kind of proud immigrant heritage. They would say it's a matter of the law and enforcing the law, as if the application of the law somehow is race-blind, it's somehow some natural force that's beyond our control. So it's this real inability to look at how laws, policies, and debates actually affect people and their lived lives, and instead to talk in these very abstract terms about laws, about fairness, that mask the very different ways that people might be affected. So I think that's one important part to realize, is that when we talk about a certain kind of liberal or progressive idea, it's always in this very abstract way. I'm not intentionally doing anything. This is simply the application of the law, even if the law's effects, you know, are devastating some people and not others. The second thing is, and that I call attention to the book, is the real, I think, collusion of some progressive and liberal organizations in passing these measures. So when Prop 187 came around, the sets of unions and even Democratic activists that were facing it were kind of, you know, they were really alarmed, and they said, we're not quite sure how to talk to voters about immigration policies. And so what they did is said, well, probably the best thing to do is to join in on some of the attacks on immigrants, which is to say, indeed, so-called illegal immigration is a problem, it's a crisis, it's bankrupting the state, but if you pass this measure, the people who are cleaning your food are going to carry disease. Their kids are going to get thrown out of school. They're going to create more crime. So they themselves traded in all of the really racist stereotypes of immigrants, in some attempt to defeat the measure, but not thinking about the broader kind of politics that were at stake. And so they both lost the measure and, I think, really conceded ground in the long run about what a humane and just immigration policy would look like.
So, in other words, one of their downfalls was the fact that they actually turned a blind eye and a blind ear or a deaf ear to the fact that there are people within their community that they're supposed to embrace who can explain the personal effects of these ballot measures, and they just decided not to listen to them.
In fact, it was very intentional. They would write memos to immigrant rights leaders saying, our consultants tell us you should not appear before the camera, you should not take leadership positions in any way, and we should really de-emphasize any notion of immigrant rights in this debate. Again, fearing that making those kinds of claims would alienate kind of white mainstream voters in particular. And it was a disastrous strategy.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 here in the city. This is More Talk Radio with myself, Celeste Carey, and my colleague, Cecil Prescott. We're speaking with Daniel Martinez-Hosang, who is the author of the book, Racial Propositions. We will be opening our lines here in just a minute. 503-231-8187. I want to go back to that whole idea of communities of color not necessarily speaking up for themselves, or maybe having the desire to and being discouraged, and then the progressive slash liberal attitude of, well, let us just keep you in the background. Two things come out of that for me. One is, what happened to the groundswell of organization and protest within the communities of color? How was that dampened so that it didn't leak out into the press or civic consciousness? And then I want to talk about, and you mentioned it in your book, in chapter one, under the idea of political whiteness, and how there was, there was a whole cachet of a social privilege at stake there.
Sure. So in terms of dampening the activism, you know, around Proposition, they actually couldn't fully dampen all the activism. So just as an example, around Proposition 187, you know, immigrants themselves were absolutely outraged that they were somehow expected and qualified to work in low-wage labor, clean toilets, maintain gardens, but their kids were not welcome in those same schools. And so they marched some 100,000 strong several weeks before the election. The official campaign against Proposition 187, led by many Democrats and labor unions, was absolutely outraged that they would try to subvert their campaign plan like this. They pleaded with them, please don't march, please stay out of the public, this is going to undermine our campaign, we don't want them to see this. And, you know, the folks refused, and at that point it was one of the largest marches, really, and you could say worker marches in Los Angeles history. So that was part of the tension, is that they tried to do it, but ultimately they couldn't contain it altogether. And that certainly spurred this enormous voter registration process in the aftermath of Proposition 187, which explains why Latinos have registered at such high rates in the last 15 years, and the Democrats actually held significant offices in California in the most recent election. So that's, I think, the hopeful side of that, the Prop 187 story, is that people's voices actually couldn't be suppressed. The concept of political whiteness I talk about is that expectation that, and the understanding that voters have, that while we talk sometimes in general about public opinion as if it's not racialized, we're often really talking about white public opinion and really white middle class public opinion. Mm-hmm. So that when we say, well, we can't make a strong stand for immigrant rights because it'll upset voters, we're actually talking about certain groups of voters. Mm-hmm. Right. And while we might expect some conservative strategists to want to appeal to that, the problem is when progressive and Democrats say, well, that also has to be the center of our politics, we also have to affirm that perspective, that's where I think you lose ground in kind of long-term politics and long-term vision.
I want to expand for you to expand a little bit more on this concept of political whiteness, and in the sense of looking at how this concept has changed or shaped over the years. Certainly, in your book, you look over 50 years in terms of ballot initiatives, and in the past 50 years, the demographics of California, indeed the nation, has changed. So I'm wondering whether or not that the strategy has changed as the demographics has changed and the state has become more diverse, and how that concept of political whiteness has changed or altered, if it has, over the decades.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the surprises as this book unfolded for me was, in fact, that the 90s were simply the latest chapter in a long legacy of these kinds of debates in California. So, you know, just as an example, in 1946, California voters considered fair employment practices policies on the ballot. They rejected that. In 1964, they approved a measure to make racial discrimination in housing a constitutionally protected practice. In the 1970s, they overturned school desegregation policies. And in the 1980s, they passed initiatives making English the official language of the state. So actually, there's a long history of political whiteness and kind of racial liberalism working hand in hand. And a great example of political whiteness earlier in the state's history is that 1964 measure, where realtors were trying to overturn recently passed fair housing measures. And they certainly didn't come out on the ballot and try to formally stand up for segregation. What they asked for is to defend property rights. And that their whole campaign was built around property rights. But again, these are not property rights for everyone. These are really white property rights. They represent the right, the so-called right, of white owners and residents to discriminate on the basis of race and religion. So when they say voters should defend property rights, they're really only addressing white voters, because that's who, the only group that would recognize they even have a right like this. And it, once again, the Democrats, and this is Jerry Brown's father, Pat Brown, in the 60s, don't really challenge and say, you know, you actually don't have that right. That's not a right you should fight for. It's not a right you should celebrate. It's a right we should figure out how we can collectively overcome. Instead, they say, fair housing laws won't really disturb those rights. Your neighborhoods really won't change. You don't have to worry much about it. So they affirm that notion that you have that right to discriminate. And that's what I call political whiteness, is that expectation that your needs, your life, your experience can be at the center of political debate, and you really don't have to regard the kind of claims, interests, and ideas of others. And I think that's a very, very dangerous framework to kind of communicate and develop political ideas within.
You're listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking this morning with Daniel Martinez-Hosang, author of Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. We invite your calls to speak with our guests, and perhaps you can respond to the question, do you think racism or political whiteness has shaped any recent political ballot initiatives in Oregon? Our numbers are 503-231.
Mm-hmm. 8187.
And I believe we have a caller waiting online. Good morning, caller.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great.
Just fine. How are you?
Good, good. I first would like to say that I am a Hispanic American. My two parents came up from El Salvador. I think it was either in the late 70s or early 80s. And we ended up moving up to Oregon, Milwaukee in the early 90s. And growing up in different types of neighborhoods, I realized that, to me, I think the issue really comes down to the employers. And it seems to me that we always seem to victimize the victims. And I myself was a victim of an employer that had two guys that were illegal. I knew they were illegal. Everybody there knew they were illegal. And I had to speak up for myself because they were trying to make me work over 40 hours a week. And I said, hey, if you want me to work over 40 hours a week, you need to pay me overtime. And he just said, no, it's fine. He just had the other guys work even more. And at the same time, he would rip them off. And it seems to me that some people always benefit when they turn it into a racist issue when it's really not a racist issue. To me, it seems like it's just the rich people trying to get richer off of people they could get take advantage of. You know, they did it to the Irish people when the Irish people first came to America, and it seems like every culture or every race group has always gone through this. And it's just, you know, it, to me, it just seems like a very simple thing to deal with, but nobody really talks about how to solve the issue. If we were just to pass a law where if a employer got caught hiring illegals and we charged him $10,000 for every illegal, this would stop overnight. And I don't understand why it's so hard to do that, other than, you know, there's people that benefit from the situation the way it is.
Certainly.
Daniel, any thoughts, comments?
Sure, sure. I mean, one, there are laws already in place and have been for many years that regulate that a person has to be documented in order to be hired. But I think it's exactly right that enforcement of many, many kind of labor laws, certainly wage and hour laws. I mean, wage theft among low-wage workers is a huge, huge problem that the, you know, caller really brings attention to. But I don't think we need to think about the kind of so-called, like, greed of employers as separate from race, because if we look at who wage and hour laws typically aren't enforced on behalf, they almost always track to people who are regarded as largely disposable by the kind of broader society, that are looked at as kind of machines that it can be worked and then disposed. And I think until we change those ideas about that, we all, I mean, these are not just policies, but they're actually ideas. Ideas about what basic fundamental rights all workers have, policing whether one's papers allow one to work or not to work, has for generations proven ineffective at raising the kind of the wage floor for all of us. So that's why I think this goes beyond simply just enforcement or simply trying to sort out who's authorized and not, but really dealing with the ideas behind it, why some workers are regarded as so disposable.
Thank you, caller, for sharing your thoughts. One thing that the caller mentioned in his comments, just listening to his language, and I was wondering whether or not this ties into your sense of the concept of political whiteness and how things are shaped, and referring to some immigrants as illegals and not being the thought police here. But I'm wondering if somehow how we discuss issues are shaped by either the dominant culture in terms of how we begin to address some of these issues.
Right, and how that plays into that abstraction of effect that you mentioned earlier in our conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think we can imagine the term so-called illegal, also kind of criminal, thug, all of these categories that once you're placed in there, it's impossible to make any kind of defense of your person, your experience, your body, or your life, and you can then be the subject of these kinds of violence. And I think the very fact that that term illegal has so penetrated our political consciousness and so many people use it is evidence of that, of the kind of pervasive effect of political whiteness. I certainly make the argument in the book that you don't have to identify as white or claim to be white in order to kind of participate in political whiteness. And the very concept that some people, that a human being can be illegal, is, I think, testament to that. And the other thing we have to remember is that this is not a term that's in widespread use really until the last 10 to 15 years. And it's really in the last couple of years that that term has become so pervasive that even self-proclaimed liberals will use it without hesitation, without, I think, realizing the violence that it does.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Daniel Martinez-Hosang, and you have an opportunity to join in the conversation with us as we discuss the racial aspects of propositions and ballot measures and how they have both been used as a tool of exclusion and a tool to protect hegemony of political whiteness. 503-231-8187. Join in the conversation. I want to kind of move forward here, both in time, but also in your book, and that's with regard to the idea that we needed to have a state language to further crystallize this idea of political power within the progressive and liberal communities and the conservative communities when it comes to putting forth, creating an image of who we are and creating an image of other. And so by declaring that English is going to be the state language, the official state language, it's kind of like crystallizing this whole thing of political whiteness. But the language was used was that rather than it creating a them and us, we were actually going to unify California. To me, that seems to be one of the an exquisite, an ugly, an exquisite use of language to hide what the real intention is, and to make it harder for people to understand just how they're voting against their self-interest.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely some of the most kind of insidious parts of this. So when English-only legislation was debated and passed in California, it was absolutely passed as a kind of immigrant empowerment policy that this assists people in learning English and therefore assisting in their assimilation. And, of course, denying people access to multilingual materials is not a kind of tool of empowerment, and certainly no immigrant rights groups held that position. But in 1996, the effort to end affirmative action was called the California Civil Rights Initiative. And the 1998 effort to eliminate bilingual education was called English for the Children. And even back to the 1940s, the effort to oppose anti-discrimination practices was led by a group called the Committee for Tolerance. So it's once again a case where kind of lofty and idealized language is actually used to mask and to justify policies that will reinforce certain kinds of hierarchy and subordination, and to allow people the notion that, you know, I'm a fair, tolerant, open-minded person. After all, I'm voting for an English for the Children measure, even if I know, or even whether or not I know that it'll result in kind of continuing to segregate large sections of students. So I think that's absolutely one of the real kind of insidious ways that ballot initiatives in particular can distract from the lived impacts of some of these policies.
And you are listening to KBOO FM. We're speaking this morning with Professor Daniel Martinez-Hosang of the University of Oregon. His book, Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Hi. My name is Max, and I want to get back to the propositions for a second. I don't want to stray too far away from them, but I have some problems with the idea of people being illegal, and most of these people being indigenous people. If you just look at them, they're indigenous people. They're not Latino or Hispanic, as they've been labeled, most of them. The idea of an illegal country, in my view, the United States is, which is based on land theft, genocide, and slavery, has the audacity to turn around and label somebody as illegal. I find it interesting that we don't talk about our history of genocide and slavery and how that relates to our law system or our legal system. And I find it kind of nutty, and I think it's confusing to children and everybody, all of us. I'd just like to hear what the professor thinks about that.
Thank you. Oh,
thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think those are really important points. I mean, it's always important to remember, it's certainly true in Oregon and everywhere in the U.S., that the immigrant population is itself diverse by origin, by experience, by class, in many different ways. And certainly indigenous communities from Mexico and Central America are an important part of the immigrant community here today, and I think that's important. And I think it also raises this dilemma of how do we think about the possibility for realizing racial justice, racial equality, broader questions of social justice, when we know we have a history that's so dominated by these really virulent forms of violence and kind of inhumanization. And I think part of what I kind of try to work through in the book is the notion that what certainly doesn't work is this notion of kind of claiming innocence. And I think the caller speaks to that as well, which is, we'll acknowledge that that happened, but it always seems to happen somewhere else. It happened in another time or in another place. It happens in the South. It happens in the 19th century, but it's not a part of our lives. And I think if we're to genuinely, honestly grapple with the legacy of those issues, we have to think seriously about the ways that these histories affect, you know, our lived experiences today, and how addressing them is absolutely fundamental to solving many of the broader crises we face. So I think it's striking a balance between not thinking that given this legacy, there's in fact nothing we can do, but it's also about taking seriously how we might address it in our day-to-day politics and lives today.
I thought that was a very important point you just made. It struck me in terms of our living history. Oftentimes, as you suggested, we speak of another time or another place, and especially I think within progressive or so-called liberal circles, we think of them or those types of folks, and rather than seeing how it impacts our everyday reality. And the fact that you've written a book on about a so-called politically progressive state and how we continue to vote on these type of measures reveals at least that we have not wrestled with some of these long-term issues.
Yeah, and in Oregon, you know, Oregon is the only state in its original constitution which has a racial exclusion law built into its founding constitution. It has a long history of using racially restrictive covenants to keep housing segregated, actually a long history of deportations as well. So it's not to then say, this is not to kind of collectively, you know, cast or of shame over us as a populace, but also to consider how those ideas, how those policies, how those laws shape what we think about politics today, shape how we think about even kind of who stands in for a so-called true Oregonian today. And I think those require, you know, candid, honest conversations.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. And if you want to be part of this candid conversation, you can do so by dialing 503-231-8187 and join the conversation with Professor Daniel Martinez Hosong. We'll go to our next caller who's been waiting. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Yeah, I'd like to take this off the air answer, but I looked on the computer to see if there's any current event or anything that would cross-reference political figure of color, Indian, in Congress, any lawmakers. I couldn't find one. Could you find a website that I could look up these Indians that have helped to create our law up to today's date? Because it is modern times or today's date.
Okay, now you're speaking, and I want to make sure I hear you properly because you were breaking up as you were speaking.
Oh.
And so if I understand what you're requesting is, you're saying you couldn't find anything where Native people contributed to any of the laws that we have currently.
Yeah.
Did I hear you correctly?
That's correct. That govern us, not just Native Americans. I'm looking for, minorities, people, of any sort, of any color. Chinese, black, it doesn't matter. And I'm not seeing very much that have contributed to this great America. And
okay,
we are part
so
of it.
So
we are part of it.
So I really would like to hear Professor Hosang's response to that, and I have a couple of thoughts myself.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. I mean, obviously, on any kind of factual basis, it's both entirely incorrect. Because there's a strong argument to be made that it was in fact the labor of people brought in that absolutely made this country possible. Their labor, their intellect, their bodies, and their lives. So to do violence to that, I think, is another example today of how we can validate and legitimate some people's lives over others in the name of. Kind of what makes the country exceptional and great. I think that does kind of shape why it can be so difficult to have these conversations and to look seriously at the kinds of policies we might need to adopt.
Well, the other thing that concerns me is, I'm not going to try to read intent, but I'm wondering how this person defines contribution and also looks at the system that would capture that information. If we live in what has already been described as an inherently racist or society that has no problem with excluding the contributions of people, what makes us think that that same system is going to keep a record of the contributions of these people, especially when these are contributions made in laws that govern us?
I mean, I do think it's important to remember that that legacy and that transcript of our lives certainly is with us, in part because, in spite of all of the, sometimes virulent forms of subordination and exclusion, people have resisted. They have found ways to make lives and space to find happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's a reason not to kind of despair, but to be hopeful that in spite of this legacy, people are still here, people are still trying to build lives. And I think it's why we always have to remain alert that when people try to make claims that somehow this history doesn't exist, that we really understand the role that understanding this past history plays in the possibility for realizing kind of future possibilities of justice and inclusion.
You're listening to KBOO FM. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. We're speaking this morning with Professor Daniel Martinez Hosang, author of Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. Give us a call if you have comments or thoughts on how race and racism has shaped recent political and or ballot initiatives in our state. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning.
Hi, this is a very fascinating radio program because it helps us here in Oregon to help prepare for future right-wing laws that we'll be facing too in upcoming elections. I noticed one issue that was really impressed me was the importance of grassroots protests against these right-wing protests and how one protest in California, I think it was 187, how the leadership of both, not just labor, but also the immigrant communities, the leadership tried to divert it. And that was really appalling. And I think another issue is that we need to understand about what many of these diverse cultures come from. Because I know several years ago in the Somalian community, when they came under attack by the FBI up in Seattle, there was a lot of street protests, and the government backed off. But here in Portland, with the entrapment of this young man, I don't see this kind of protest against this entrapment by the FBI. The other thing I want to talk about is here in Oregon, is that we've got a large immigrant population here, and they've been very militant in helping organize our unions. And we're seeing we're starting to see a resurgence in our union organizing here, and we don't hear about that. And I did want to add that we need to learn about these other people's cultures. Like here in Portland, I do live next door to neighbors who are Somalian, so I do hear about the problems they face, and discrimination they face. And also I want to invite people. I know this is it's my own sales pitch, but this coming Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. at the Brent Rose Center at our new address at 6834 Northeast Gleason, we'll be talking about the women's upsurge here in Argentina, where over 25,000 women got together at a convention in October to talk about how to promote women's rights. And these women were in the struggles in their own factories, in their own homes, in their own schools and hospitals, and they were organizing on there. And some of these people are now immigrate to here to Oregon, and they're also organizers. So it's a good chance to see what's happening in Latin America and what we can learn about to work with immigrants here in Portland. And anybody who has any questions, they can give us a call at 503-240-4462. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Interesting points you brought up. Some time ago, we had guest Kent Wong, who is from UCLA and works in the Labor and Research Center there, to discuss not only the fact that immigrants were the driving force for union establishment here in the United States, but how they really help us pump new blood into unions right now. And I know that there are some challenges that we still face to not only unions being involved because of the just to be really blunt, unions themselves have to purge the racism that they have within them before they can effectively reach out to immigrant and refugee populations. But the fact that quite often you still have labor organizations with white leadership signing on to some of these more damaging ballot initiatives.
Yeah, I think that makes really, really great points. Or they'll formally take a stance against it, but won't really do the work among
right.
their membership and constituencies to say what's at stake for all of us here. And I think, you know, the point Ken makes about California labor history is really instructive. For many years, when there were very high-wage, unionized manufacturing jobs in California that were largely, although not exclusively, white, the need to organize immigrant workers didn't seem as pronounced. The labor movement was comfortable. It actually policed some workers away from these jobs, and they thought that that base of power would give them, you know, kind of legitimate position. And what they found is when those jobs moved away, it wasn't those white workers that were militant, in part because they thought that whiteness would protect them from some of these forces. And so unions took many, many years. It's not really until the early 1990s that California unions began to take seriously that the driving force, that the people who feel vulnerable and therefore understand the importance of collective organization, were going to be immigrant workers. And I think we could see a similar thing happening in Oregon, where there is a long and important tradition of trade union organizing, though it's mostly been a white tradition. And as those organizations come under greater attack, whether the political energy that's going to be necessary to oppose them lies entirely within the organized base, or there's new workers that understand the importance of solidarity, collective action, that need to very, very quickly be brought into this process if a really robust response is going to be possible.
Are there any ballot initiatives that you see, or any trends, rather, that you see that may develop into ballot initiatives that we might face here in Oregon? One of the key points that you mentioned earlier is the fact that Oregon as a state is infamous for having race actually written into its state constitution. So we know that we have a strong platform of racial exclusion here historically in this state. And we've so far been able to avoid having some of the really large efforts at racially divisive ballot initiatives that California has had. But do you see any changes coming down the pike?
I mean, one, I think that it's important, especially, for example, around issues like immigration. There are always political forces in Oregon that would be, if resources got to them, very, very anxious to qualify a measure similar to this, in part because Oregon's ballot is relatively open and accessible. Things like anti-affirmative action initiatives and initiative related to bilingual education actually did qualify in 2008 and was very narrowly defeated. So I think there's always the danger that some of those initiatives loom on the horizon. But, you know, the one that I want to certainly call attention to is it's been prison expansion.
Yes.
That has been, you know, in the last 20 years, just been disastrous for the state and almost entirely won through the ballot. And I think there are some very, very subtle racial overtones even to that debate. This notion that if we don't, in fact, build these industrial cages similar to California, that we're going to be vulnerable, something about our great life here in the state is going to be taken away from us. I don't think you can entirely divorce that from these kind of founding visions of Oregon, that settlers who came here left a place that was threatened and vulnerable to establish this kind of new state. And so when people say, you know, your stuff is a danger, someone's going to come for you, voters are very quick to say, well, what do I need to do to protect myself? And I think, you know, as a result, we have now this, you know, spending a larger proportion of our general fund than any other state on prisons and spending much more now on prisons and higher education. So, I think those debates aren't explicitly racialized. It shows how some notion of whiteness in politics can be harnessed to really reactionary ends. And that now affects all of us, you know, whether we have loved ones inside or not.
Related to that, and this reflects back to an earlier caller in terms of organizing against these type of propositions, I think in some community or historically in societies, not looking back to a golden age, but say particularly in the Southern Belt when it was mostly African Americans and white in the community and that types of struggle. What we have here is an increasingly diverse, multicultural, multi-ethnic society, and I imagine it's much more difficult to one, recognize the challenges that we face in terms of opposing initiatives that have racial overtones, but also in terms of organizing communities and also pitting communities against one another. The question I therefore have is, how do we organize diverse cultural and ethnic communities to oppose these type of dangerous initiatives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that organizing is always, I mean, Portland in particular, but the state has a kind of rich tapestry of organizations and lots of different communities that are underway and that understand that there's different approaches that are working in different communities. So I don't think it's a matter of as much a matter of, let's say, so finding the so-called common ground. I think, you know, groups are doing that. They recognize where there's shared self-interest, where there's independent organizing that needs to take place. But famously, I think it was Richard Wright that was asked in the 1950s in the U.S. By a French reporter about the so-called Negro problem in the U.S., and he said, there's no so-called Negro problem. There's a white problem. There's a problem. The problem of endemic racism has to do with challenging notions of whiteness, and I think in Oregon in particular, even in the kind of liberal and progressive movement, that's something that has to continue to be addressed, which is what assumptions about whiteness, about the privileges associated with it, even shape and affect contemporary progressive organizing, and how are we making room for those kinds of diverse communities and experiences to be heard.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott, myself, Celeste Carey. We're speaking with Professor Daniel Martinez-Hosang, who is the author of the book Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. There are a few minutes left. If you'd like to join in the conversation, dial 503-231-8187. Part of our issue, as we've understood it, both the way you've outlined it and as other people have so eloquently stated, is our idea of what is the correct racial identity. and then even the unconscious protection of political whiteness that many newcomers, immigrants, and refugees find in, you know, that they're becoming indoctrinated with. How do we, as caring and compassionate and aware and alert people, start dismantling that political whiteness and help people recognize that there is much more strength and prosperity and equality and equity?
Yeah, I think the question raises an interesting contradiction because on the one hand, it's certainly precisely those values of tolerance, compassion, integrity, and solidarity that would bring us together and fuel the kind of, I think, multiracial, multigenerational forms of political action that are called for at the moment. At the same time, I think there's a danger. I mean, the writer James Baldwin said, kind of, it's the innocence that's the crime. It's the proclaiming when we embrace and claim that we have, we are ourselves completely innocent, we are the sole possessors of tolerance, that we've already done all the work inside that needs to take place, that actually can blind us from hearing the experiences of people who are different from us and their own claims and their own kind of political needs and beliefs. So I think part of it is while we have to take those values seriously, we also have to look very much in practice as to how they're kind of being implemented, how our agendas are being shaped, making sure that they're shaped by diverse voices, and not assuming that because we've pronounced our own commitments to justice, that you know, that work is done, and it's simply kind of other people's problems. So, I think it actually is a lot of internal work, even within the progressive community, about opening up space for multiple visions and demands.
As you study this issue and continue to write and observe these issues, I'm wondering if you would share with us, not only as you just did so well in terms of how to vision and imagine the future, but are there any trends that you see that we should be aware of? I'm speaking particularly because I'm concerned in terms of the so-called Tea Party movement and their offering of a vision of our society that, as you stated, is somewhat exclusionary and a figment of many of our imaginations. Is this a new phenomenon we should be aware of? Are there lessons from history we should take in terms of countering this narrative?
I mean, I think it's a great question, Cecil. I think that, well, first, I think the earlier point that you made about even just thinking about our use of language and the quote, term, quote-unquote, illegal, I think that actually looms very, very large. We have something like 12 million undocumented folks in this country, and the notion that you can have 12 million rightless people, people without not just formal rights, but any rights to assert that their lives should be defended within a country's borders, really harkens back to times right after Reconstruction when recently emancipated folks were kind of living as rightless subjects in the state. So I actually think that's an enormous crisis that we don't even have the language. If we consider the 12 million people without legal status or the some 2 million people in prisons and jails in the country, we're having an increasingly large section of our population that are essentially rightless bodies, and that's just an enormous, enormous crisis. And I think that while the recent activity of the Tea Party certainly deserves scrutiny and really, really a careful response, I'm much more concerned, frankly, about self-proclaimed liberal and moderate political leaders who are only all too happy to make all kinds of concessions, political or ideological, around kind of pragmatic arguments. This is the climate we're in. We need to be reasonable, which will kind of bargain away our ability to make future robust claims for justice. Mm-hmm. And part of what I try to show in this book is that every time that's been tried on the ballot, so when the realtors insist, what about our property rights? What about our rights to send our kids to neighborhood schools? What about our language rights? What about the rights to our state? That the Democrats have said, look, this is getting out of hand. We have to cut some deals. That's how we'll, you know, secure some body of hope for ourselves. It never, ever works. It really, really doesn't. And I think now more than ever is the time to figure out about what we collectively stand for, believe in, what we think everyone has the right to deserve, and then express that unapologetically.
I also see one thing, and you mentioned this earlier, and that was in relation to Proposition 187 and the way it not only spurred an increase in the Latino registration and vote, but also grassroots protests. Is be willing to get out and do the work in your community for yourself and don't look to so-called allies to speak on your behalf.
Yes, I think, you know, there's great groups here, Gausa in Salem, the group Pikun in Woodburn, that are doing exactly that, that are doing independent organizing, that's certainly multiracial and depends on solidly on allies, but exactly right, knows that part of this is doing independent organizing. And I think, I mean, that's, again, one of the upsides of this question of racialized ballot propositions. The 94 measure stimulated a lot of organizing in immigrant communities. That's paying certain kinds of benefits today. The effort to defeat affirmative action, while it passed, I think politicized a whole generation of college students and other activists in California who sensed even 15 years ago the crisis that was beginning to face the California budget. So I think that's the upside. And I think certainly on the positive side, in California, there's groups getting ready to think about overturning Prop 13, the very regressive property tax measure passed in 1978. They're trying to use some of the lessons from past ballot measures to see what a forward-thinking kind of equality measure might look like on the ballot in the future. And then here in Oregon, folks considering a measure that would recognize same-sex marriage as well. So we could also perhaps use some of these tools as vehicles to do the kind of independent organizing that will change the balance of power.
Well, thank you so much for spending this hour with us, Professor. We've appreciated the time and the thought that you have given. Your book, again, is Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. And your name, the author, is Daniel Martinez Hosang. Thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Cecil. Thank you, Celeste, for your great show and all the great work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
And let me remind you that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, the OMO Variety Hour looks at how to save the public schools from the privatizer and build the schools children deserve with Rethinking Schools editor Stan Kopp. At 10, here at Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Eric DePlace of Sightline Institute talks about global warming and the Northwest. At 11 on Health and Healthcare Forum, we hear a discussion of the book, The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger. At 11:30 on Madness Radio, the guest is Daniel Mackler, a former psychotherapist who specialized in treating people with psychosis without medication. And tune in tonight at 6 for Labor Radio for a discussion of General Motors' celebrated comeback and its co-host and its cost to workers with Jerry Tucker, co-founder of the UAW New Directions Movement. Also, Rachel Bristol of Oregon Food Bank discusses hunger in Oregon. And please join us on this program, More Talk Radio, next Monday, when our guest will be Harvard historian James Kloppenberg, who will talk about his new book, Reading Obama, Dreams, Hopes, and the American Political Tradition. All of this here on your community radio station, KBOO-FM.